Good morning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A quick note on yesterday's program. During a conversation about Enbridge's Line 5 oil and gas pipeline, we misidentified the Michigan authority that recently approved advancing the project. The agency is the Michigan Public Service Commission. And if you missed the conversation, you can listen online at WPR.org/mornings. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Antibiotic resistance poses a global threat. It becomes harder to treat infections as the effectiveness of antibiotics diminish. College students across the world and here in Wisconsin work together to find solutions in soil, and they converge in Green Bay for the Tiny Earth Winter Symposium at Lambeau Field. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brian Merkel is an associate professor and chair of human biology at UW-Green Bay. He's organizing the Tiny Earth Symposium set for next week. Brian, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, good morning, Kate. It's really a pleasure to be here with you and the listeners today.
Well, you organized this event in part to take action on antibiotic resistance. How serious is the threat?
It's very serious, and even before the pandemic, it was a leading cause of death worldwide. But unfortunately, the COVID pandemic did occur, and when you have patients that have pulmonary process and they have a fever, what that often means clinically is that you're going to prescribe antibiotics while you perform tests and investigate further to determine what the cause is. But these are emergency cases, and oftentimes that means prescribing antibiotics. And given all the cases around the world where all those antibiotics were being prescribed because of COVID infections, it's just given these very, very effective microorganisms more opportunities to develop resistance. So we are in the billions in the United States every single year because of six of these nasty organisms that have become highly antibiotic resistant. And by 2050, the predictions are that deaths due to antibiotic resistant organisms will match deaths caused by cancer.
Wow. Well, enter college students who across the globe are collecting soil to be tested for antibiotic research. What are students doing after they collect these soil samples?
So, yeah, it's really this innovative curriculum called Tiny Earth, right? And it's really exciting. It's a transformative experience for students. And as you indicated, they're doing this all over the world. Approximately 14,000 students annually around the world. It starts with a soil sample, their innovative ideas about where to look, where to go. And then over the course of 14 weeks, they're characterizing the antibiotic activity of the metabolites that these soil bacteria are producing.
Do the soil samples vary quite a bit in what's in the soil across the globe?
Yes, it can vary quite a bit. Students are looking at a variety of different locations. And so the hope is ultimately, as we gather this information around the world and enter the information into the largest soil database around the world, the Tiny Earth Soil Database, one of the hopes is that ultimately we could create soil maps, if you will, with GPS data that's attached to these sample sites with other geospatial data that you would use artificial intelligence software and machine learning platforms to identify through those mechanisms those sites that harbor soil isolates that hold the greatest promise in terms of antibiotic production. So that's one of the great hopes that we have as we join in this collaborative effort around the world.
UW-Green Bay Associate Professor Brian Merkel with us as we talk about antibiotic research, the Tiny Earth Symposium that is set for next week. You can join in questions and comments on antibiotic research, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Brian, two Northeast Wisconsin Technical College students recently discovered a new antibiotic in a park in Howard, Wisconsin. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so one of the great things that Tiny Earth provides through these research opportunities that are built into the curriculum of our courses, and this is through the great efforts of a colleague of mine. His name is Dr. Angelo Kolakithis from NWTC. Because of the Tiny Earth curriculum, he in fact had two students, because of their great efforts, struck gold, as it were, and found some very, very promising isolates that they decided to pursue further. And it culminated into some publications. So we're really excited about that. Angelo really does an amazing job because, as we all know, it's doing research can be tough wherever you are, but Angelo's been able to do this at NWTC. So it's really a credit to what Angelo does and the students that he works with. And I would think, too, the infrastructure and support that NWTC is providing Dr. Kolakithis.
And apparently what the students found was important because it wasn't toxic to humans. Can you explain that distinction?
Yeah, so it's important, right? When we find these metabolites, these compounds that these soil isolates produce, one of the things that can happen is that we can find that they have activity against bacteria that can cause infections. So while that's important, sometimes what we have to be careful about and what we have to know is that whether or not these same compounds that can work against things that we worry about that can cause infections, can we also determine whether or not they could have toxicity in humans? So one of the great aspects of the work that they did at NWTC is that they actually took a look at that.
And so Ideas Network, are you calling to get on the air?
Oh, I'm sorry. We just had a carry on.
That's fine. So yeah, it's really important that these compounds, right, that they have efficacy for the things that we are concerned about, but we're also concerned about safety issues too. So I think very wisely, Angelo and his team of students at NWTC were looking at both of those things.
We have UW Green Bay Associate Professor of Biology. Brian Merkel is a Tiny Earth instructor, organizer of its symposium. Call in with a question. You can share your views. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin college students in the Tiny Earth program, they take part in an international research effort to help discover novel antibiotics to address the increasingly concerning issue of antibiotic resistance. And they share their work at a Tiny Earth symposium set for Green Bay. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question at your views, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. UW Green Bay Associate Professor of Biology Brian Merkel is organizing the event. Brian, part of the Tiny Earth mission is to encourage people from underrepresented groups to enter STEM fields. And you say 60% of students who start their undergrad careers with a STEM major eventually switch. Why is this happening? Why do students typically switch?
Well, yeah, it's a fascinating conversation to have about that. And I think all too often in the past, we've always thought that we had to fix the student. It was something deficient in students. They just couldn't handle the curriculum. And I think what we're seeing now is an important change in how college educators are approaching the classroom. And so the idea is to fix the environment, fix the classroom, not so much worry about fixing the student. And so what's powerful about the Tiny Earth curriculum is that we're turning students loose. It's really interesting to think that for so many years, generally, the way that we've approached teaching science as educators is a lot of observation, not a lot of touching, not a lot of really doing the doing of science, right? So, and those are the things, the irony here is those are the things that scientists love about science, but yet we were preventing students from doing just that in the classroom. So turning students loose through a course-based undergraduate research experience like Tiny Earth, which happens to be a very powerful one because students are actually doing research on a global health crisis. So there's several cures, as we call them, out there, but the Tiny Earth one, again, is really powerful because of the reasons articulated. So the agency that they have, it's they start with a soil sample. They are contributing to their community in a very relevant way. They are collaborating together. They see the value of iteration, right? When you do science, you repeat things, you have to troubleshoot. So all of those kinds of things and going through that experience in a college course tends to be really powerful them, powerful for them. And so what we're seeing is that it's changing that disturbing trend, right? So we have a shortfall, a projected shortfall in healthcare professionals and physicians and in scientists. And so cures like Tiny Earth are changing all that for the reasons mentioned. And so it's really important, right? So we have this global pandemic of antibiotic resistance. We have a shortfall of physicians. And let's face it, if you're not interested in science, it's difficult to become a physician because all of these things are science-based, and we have to do a much better job of not just inspiring students with their initial interest, right? We want to nurture that. We want to show them that their interest is well served, it's well placed by providing environments that nurture that. And Tiny Earth, I think, does a great job of that. And it's scalable too. So when we talk about underrepresented communities, right? Individuals that have to work after school, or they are the daycare center for their families, so they can't participate in traditional opportunities that colleges provide students to engage in one-on-one independent studies, because these experiences are built into a course, it provides much more access for these communities.
In terms of that scalability, how does a biology professor or instructor become a Tiny Earth instructor? I just wonder, are you recruiting more schools and more educators to lead this?
Yeah, that happens every year. So the Tiny Earth headquarters is based on the UW Madison. The founder, her name is Jo Handelsman. And so she was tired of that trend and really frustrated by that trend of we're losing 60% of the students, and why don't we empower ourselves to fix the classroom? That was her idea. And so, through a lot of things, to her credit, what she did certainly is at UW Madison, there are training opportunities that happen a couple times a year. It's a week-long process where college educators across the country, around the world, are invited to spend time to learn techniques, not only scientific techniques that are needed to identify antibiotic activity among soil bacteria, but also teaching techniques that tend to work really well when we talk about science and STEM fields. So all those things happen on a regular basis every single year.
I wonder, does Tiny Earth align with the priorities of other larger health organizations? I'm thinking about the World Health Organization and its goals to address drug-resistant bacteria.
Yeah, absolutely. It does align with that. When you think about this crisis, right, it really requires a multi-pronged strategy. It requires a lot of collaboration to deal with these very, very large-scale problems, right? In this case, it's a healthcare problem, it's a world crisis, it's a public health crisis. So number one, we have to do a better job educating students. We We want to inspire them. We want to show them that they can do science. We want to retain them in these kinds of fields. We have to do antibiotic discovery in this case. Pharmaceutical companies have abandoned this process.
And I want to pause right there because there is that sentiment that pharmaceutical companies have not invested into research on this area and into research and developing new antibiotics. And what is your take on this?
Well, I mean, it's a business, so right? I mean, we all get that. So, to be fair to them, it's, we have other ways of making business or making money, and so we're going to pursue those opportunities. So the fact that we have not been good stewards of antibiotics as human beings because we've overprescribed and undertaken and it's been inappropriately used in areas of animal husbandry and the rest of it. So we've abused the privilege as human beings. We've abandoned, many businesses have abandoned antibiotic discovery. So it's left us with this problem. So, Tiny Earth, again, the curriculum excites students in ways that we've never seen before, but it's particularly powerful again because it's not research just attached to any point of interest. The research that these students are doing is filling a critical need, antibiotic discovery. And so it does all these things, and these students get that. They feel that. And when they go to a symposium like the one that we're having at Lambeau Field Monday,
So,
at a free community event with their family and friends looking on, there's so much pride in that building. So the value of science and medicine that is conveyed so effectively because the message is coming from the students. It amazes all of us on the planning committee that during these very divided times and these cynical times that we have inadvertently come up with a strategy. We actually have a publication on this that we put out recently over this past year. We did not set out to do things this way. The members of the planning committee initially just, we should provide an opportunity for students to communicate their science and what they've learned, right? Science is incomplete unless it's communicated. So trying to be good facilitators, teachers, educators for these students, a number of us are like-minded individuals. College of Menominee Nation, St. Norbert College, UW Green Bay, NWTC got together and we decided Lambeau would just be a great place. But as it turns out, lo and behold, what we discovered is it's a powerful voice to communicate the value of education, collaboration, science, medicine, and the rest. And it's such an inspirational thing, the value of collaboration. The students end up being role models for all of us, quite frankly, and we are there to support them.
UW Green Bay Associate Professor of Biology, Brian Merkel, with us, giving us a preview of the Tiny Earth curriculum and the symposium set for next week. You can join in questions at 800-642-1234. Brian, a bit more on this really large and growing soil database and the samples and the culture conditions. How is this information coordinated across the world as far as this database?
Yeah, so again, it's the wisdom and the team of Joe Handelsman. Joe Handelsman is the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery on the UW-Madison campus. For all the amazing things that she has done in terms of her contributions in science, I think her true legacy is going to be a mentor. She is a mentor to all the Tiny Earth partner instructors that exist throughout the world today. And so she organizes all these things, her team at the WID, as we call it. Organize all this, the database. So when all these courses are running around the world, which they do, like ours in the fall, Part of the process at the end of the course is that the students get together with their instructors around the world, and we enter in together all the information, the exciting information about the antibiotic activity that's produced by these soil bacteria. It gets entered into the database that's organized and supervised, and the rest that's kept by Joe Handelsman's team. And so today they have 19 high priority isolates, which is really exciting. They've identified 10 structures, which is not a light lift, but they have the expertise and the
Oh,
equipment
well,
on the Madison campus to do all that. So that's
Brian,
where we're going.
thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure being with you. Thank you so much.
Brian Merkel, Associate Professor at UW Green Bay, leading the Tiny Earth Symposium. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We go to Capitol Hill and check in with U.S. Congressman Glenn Grothman of Wisconsin, unpacking the latest on funding priorities of Republican House leadership. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an historic synagogue and its community just in time for the start of Hanukkah.
In the early 20th century, millions of Jewish people fled Russia due to persecution and poor quality of life. Some of them ended up in Wisconsin. In Sheboygan, a former synagogue with an historic stained glass window acts as a testament to the area's once thriving Jewish community. Molly Hunken brings us their story.
Most Jewish people who emigrated from Eastern Europe to the United States came to cities, but some did settle in smaller towns. One such community was Sheboygan, Wisconsin. With a population nearing just 23,000 by 1900, the town of Sheboygan was small, not somewhere you might imagine large groups of new U.S. immigrants flocking to. However, according to Susie Alpert-Drazen, Sheboygan was where employers were hiring. Her first family member arrived there in 1904.
And they said, well, and pointing to a map of the United States, you can find work here, here, and here, and they're hiring here, here, and here. So they fronted him train ticket money, and away he went to Sheboygan, Wisconsin.
The first synagogue in Sheboygan opened its doors in 1903, and by the time Drazen was growing up there, Sheboygan was home to three synagogues.
The synagogue that my family belonged to, it was called the Brick Shul, shul meaning a Yiddish word for synagogue. That was because it was made of bricks. There was also a white shul because it was white. And then there was the Holman Shul, which the Holman family founded.
The White Shul had originally formed in the 1890s as an Orthodox congregation called Adas Israel, meaning Community of Israel. The architecture of the White Shul included a large onion dome at the top of the building, as well as a stunning stained glass window that featured a Star of David.
The window is about 6.5 feet high and 3 feet wide.
That's David Driscoll, a curator at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He shows me the window, which is now hanging up in their storage facility.
And in the middle, there's a kind of leaded glass Star of David that's kind of a mottled white and brown color.
The Wisconsin Historical Society has been able to preserve this key remnant of Adas Israel. And according to Susie Drazen, the window's material has an important purpose in Jewish culture and religion.
In Judaism, there is a concept called Hidur Mitzvah, and it means that we are beautifying the mitzvah. It's like dressing up to go to church or to synagogue. A stained glass window is something special. A stained glass window is something extra. It's beautiful.
Jewish families attended services, educated their children, and became involved in the vibrant community surrounding the White Shul for decades. But by the 1940s, much of the new generation of Sheboygan's Jews didn't feel as connected to Orthodox Judaism. So in 1944, the Orthodox congregations of Sheboygan were largely replaced by a new group called Congregation Bethel, which is the only remaining synagogue in Sheboygan. And over the last few decades, Sheboygan's Jewish population has shrunk considerably. Jonathan Pollack is the chair of the history department at Madison Area Technical College and an honorary fellow at the Center for Jewish Studies at UW-Madison. He says this is a common trend.
Jewish families in small towns, especially, you know, starting really in the 1920s, saw college as like a great thing and something they wanted their kids to pursue for all the opportunities that a college education brought, that same education meant that a lot of people were not going back home.
Having grown up in Sheboygan, Drazen agrees.
We were not encouraged to stay. We were encouraged to go to college, make a life, and perhaps find a larger Jewish community to be part of.
Drazen and Pollock both think that unless more job opportunities arise in Sheboygan, the Jewish community will likely continue to shrink. However, pieces like the Star of David window are an important reminder of the rich history of Jewish culture in Sheboygan.
Molly Hunkin brought us that story on a Sheboygan synagogue. The building's stained glass window is part of the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells our state's history through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As lawmakers on Capitol Hill struggle to reach a deal on immigration, implications extend beyond the southern border. Billions of dollars in additional aid to Ukraine are another focus of debate as it battles to push back Russian forces. We discuss policy priorities with a Wisconsin congressman, and you can take part in the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Glenn Grothman is a Republican representative from Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District in East Central Wisconsin. Congressman Grothman, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Glad to be talking to the erudite listener.
Thank you. All right. Well, this week, Senate Republicans, they block a $110 billion package that would have provided additional security assistance to Ukraine and Israel. What is your position on sending further military aid to these nations?
Well, with regard to Ukraine, the problem I have is the Biden administration is not negotiating an end to this war. All wars end sooner or later. And even when dealing with horrific dictators, I'm thinking of the end of the Korean War, eventually a peace is negotiated. The Biden administration, I voted 6 times, by the way, for more aid for Ukraine. But right now we have 2 problems here. First of all, the Biden administration is not negotiating the settlement. And somehow we got to send the message to them that, well, maybe the U.S. can't negotiate it. We should be encouraging the Turks or the French. I guess the Israelis have their hands filled right now, but somebody negotiate a settlement. The Biden administration, if you talk to them, I think they'd be satisfied if this thing were going on for another 2 years. So that's what's going on in Ukraine. As far as with regard to Israel, they need more money. We've got to get them more money. The House has, of course, already passed a bill giving enough money. We want a lot of people, though, we're not going to vote for that. I think I could vote for it, but a lot of people were not going to vote for it unless we spent less money somewhere else. We right now are borrowing over 22% of our federal budget. So I guess it's up to the, if they don't like places we made the cuts, I look forward to the Senate sending back another bill in which we reduce spending by $14 or $15 billion somewhere else.
In terms of aid to Ukraine, do you worry about President Putin's capabilities without supplemental aid to
yeah,
Ukraine?
Yeah, there's another. I am worried, but I'm even more worried about the fact that the Biden administration is not trying to do anything to negotiate a settlement. And like I said, when the Korean War went on, of course, there we were right in the middle of the war. President Eisenhower reached a settlement that had to be signed off by Mao Zedong, signed off by the North Koreans, and he was able to get it done. President Biden isn't doing that. The other thing of concern is our number one priority right now has to be the southern border. It shouldn't have to be a concern. You know, at the time President Biden took office, we were well under 20,000 people a month crossing that southern border. We're now, due to change in policy, up around 230,000. So he's increased it by a factor of about 11 times as much. And we would hope that prior to committing more money in Ukraine, that President Biden would do something at the southern border. I don't think you're going to see Republicans bring a bill to the floor to help Ukraine before President Biden does something at that southern border.
In terms of Israel, the Gaza Health Ministry estimating Israel's military response to the October 7th attacks by Hamas that have killed at least 15,000 people, including many children and civilians. As a condition of receiving further military aid, should the U.S. require Israel to change its military response?
Well, people keep asking Israel, which went through a horrific time in which over 1,000 people were killed, right? In which babies were having their heads cut off. They say Israel has to do something. I'll tell you what has to be done. Hamas could lay down their weapons, surrender at any time, and I think this thing would be over. But instead, they continue to fight. They continue not to surrender. And I think it's a horrible thing that Hamas is, therefore, keeping this war going. It's not Israel who wants to keep it going. I'm sure Israel wishes they could wipe out all these Hamas people tomorrow. But Hamas, after their horrific behavior, keeps fighting. And
Israel
has to have, and I think there's a lack of... lack of historical perspective. You look at World War II, what happened with the Dresden firebombings, or what happened in Tokyo, or what happened after the nuclear bombs. And these were many, many, many more times people died than Hamas. And we don't particularly see the Dresden firebombings. I don't think we talk about it a lot today as being a horrific thing. And here we have a situation in which Hamas keeps fighting.
If Hamas laid down its arms, we would see peace in the region?
I think so. If they surrendered, came out and said, here are our people, because that's what Israel's looking for.
You're co-sponsoring a bill that would make people ineligible to receive an American visa if using a passport issued by the Palestinian Authority. Why do you support this bill?
Well, we do not need people coming from that part of the world. You look at the type of people that are already demonstrating against Israel, the severe anti-Semitism. The people in the Palestinian Authority, they've been getting school curriculum since they were children, telling them how horrible the Jews are, how we got to wipe out Israel. We've got people all around the world trying to get in our country. Why, with all the people trying to get here, would in any circumstances we take people raised in that sort of background? Now, I suppose you can have some sympathy for them, and that nobody else wants these people. You know, Egypt could take them. They don't want them. The Saudi Arabians don't want them. The Syrians don't want them. The Lebanese don't want them. I think Americans who think about inviting these Palestinians into our country ought to stop and think first why people in these primarily Muslim countries, why they don't want any of these Palestinians.
Republican U.S. Representative Glenn Grothman represents a wide swath of East Central Wisconsin. You can take part in this discussion, call in with a question, share what you're watching for, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Sixth District Republican Congressman Glenn Grothman is here with updates on priorities of his caucus and work on Capitol Hill ahead of a holiday recess. You've aligned to this discussion. Call in with a question. Share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Congressman, turning to immigration, as Republicans and Democrats in Congress, they're at odds over military aid, as we've been talking about for Ukraine and Israel. They're also debating new steps on immigration and border security. Where do you think compromise with the Biden administration is possible?
Well, you just have to enforce the current law. Again, I mentioned when President Biden took office, we were having under 20,000 people a month coming across the southern border, sometimes well under 10,000. So we really don't even have to change anything. He's just got to go back to the old policies. I mean, it's not that difficult. We have laws on how to get in this country, right? We are already swearing in over 1 million people a year, which by historical standards is incredibly high. We do not need people either lying about the fact that they need asylum or what we call gotaways, which are largely single men sneaking across the border. We just want President Biden to enforce the current law. We do have a bill out there that has passed the House of Representatives. The Senate is not taking it up. And that bill has a variety of proposals which could improve things.
Are you talking about H.R. 2?
Correct.
H.R. 2, the real overhaul of the immigration system. It also includes resuming construction of the border wall. Are you in favor of that as well?
Right. I've been down to the border maybe 8 times now. And every time I'm down there, anybody I talk to, be it the Border Patrol agents, be it law enforcement on the southern border, believes the wall is an improvement. And what they refer to it as is kind of a wall system. It's not just a wall. It's a system in which we would be alerted if anybody was trying to get under or over the wall so the Border Patrol could get out there. It would solve the problem. I don't think any other country would be put up with 20,000 people a month crossing into it, much less 220,000, 240,000.
I want to turn to spending.
I do want to point out, we are getting over 1 million people a year sworn in this country. Nobody can say we're being xenophobic or not caring about other people. I recently attended a ceremony in Milwaukee, in which I think they had like 270 people sworn in one day at our state fair park. So nobody should fall for this idea that America isn't letting anybody in. We let a lot of people.
But I wonder what you would say then to a Wisconsin dairy farm that is deeply needs migrant workers, immigrant workers year round to keep cows milked, to keep cows healthy, to keep operations running smoothly.
As I said, it's not impossible to get in this country. You know, there are people coming in on work visas, and we have 1 million people a year being sworn.
Let's turn to spending. Federal lawmakers have about 2 weeks to avoid a partial government shutdown due to the lack of a newly authorized spending plan. How should this situation be addressed?
Well, we have finished, I think we've passed out now 9 of 12 appropriation bills, so your listeners understand our budget is made up of 12 separate bills. We're kind of waiting for proposals to come back from the Senate. We're negotiating them right now. We did reach an agreement on the numbers of the overall budget at the time we increased the debt limit. I think if we stick with those numbers, I think we should be able to get something done.
Talking with U.S. Republican Glenn Grothman about policy priorities here at the end of the year, you can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Specifically, the farm bill. Last month, lawmakers extending the 2018 farm bill to continue until September 2024. And this allows you more time to debate long-term changes to farming and food assistance. What changes are you advocating for?
I want to mention one other thing. When we talk about the budget, it's not entirely the amount of spending. President Biden has been active in his proposals, trying to get a lot more stuff in there, identifying people by race, okay, giving preferences to people by race, hiring more bureaucrats who are going to spend their life telling people that they should identify, they should view themselves as a representative of a racial group rather than an individual. And that's something that the Republicans are going to have to stand up to. We are very broke as a country. We shouldn't be hiring these people. And I could see several bills being delayed if the Democrats insist on hiring more of these people.
In terms of the farm bill, what changes are you advocating for?
Well, like you said, we push things off for another year. I think the status quo is fairly good. I think Glenn Thompson on that committee is doing a good job. They're going to, in that farm bill, we have food stamps, which is the largest share of that bill. I think we ought to be cracking down, have more people subject to work requirements there. And I would really like to see food stamps limited to more nutritious food. I've long been an advocate for taking things like Mountain Dew out of there. And that's going to be a priority of mine. I think we have to publicize it. We right now have a great program called the WIC program aimed at young mothers and children. And you can see when you go into the grocery store what you can buy on the WIC, what you can't. I think we ought to be moving in that direction on food stamps. I'll be very disappointed if they don't.
So the Farm Bill could top $1 trillion. Do you support its size, I wonder?
Well, it'd be nice if it cost less, but I think the overall amount that's going to be spent is going to meet with the negotiations we've already had with regard to with regard to raising the debt limit. And as long as we keep under those limits, I think that'll be okay.
And so in turn, you look at trying to overhaul SNAP benefits more in order to reconfigure how the Farm Bill is allocated in specifically this area of support.
Well, I think right now we are sadly encouraging people, and it's not just SNAP, though SNAP is part of the Farm Bill. We are encouraging people to adapt a certain lifestyle, right? And SNAP is other things. Discourages work or encourages, if you're going to work, work off the books. Either one of those is not appropriate. And like almost every one of these income support programs, there's a strong anti-marriage penalty associated with it. I do not like to have, it's not just that, it's low-income housing, it's earned income tax credit, all the others, but Pell Grants, all are an incentive for America to move away from the old-fashioned traditional family, and I don't like that in these programs.
I want to spend our last 30 seconds or so on your leadership and House Speaker Mike Johnson. Do you think Johnson is, receiving the opportunity to be able to, allow to do the job?
He's a very moral person. I was pleased to vote for him. He doesn't have a lot of experience. He's only been there 7 years. But as you know, the Republicans rejected four people who on paper had more experience. So we've all got to get behind Mike, give him our suggestions, realize that there's going to be a little bit of a learning curve here. But I think he is the most conservative speaker we've had in a long time. I think he's aware of the fact that a lot of the problems we have in this country, I guess I would call moral problems. And I think he's going to do what he can to try to get America back to where it used to be. I think a lot of Mike's viewpoints are very similar to my viewpoints. It'll be the fourth speaker I've dealt with since I've been to Washington and the one that is closest to my own viewpoint.
Congressman Grothman, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be on the show. And again, hope to talk to you, the erudite listeners of Wisconsin Public Radio again soon.
Glenn Grothman, Republican Congressman for the 6th Congressional District. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.